I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, Mexico's 500-year history has often been told as a series of tragedies and betrayals, but a new comprehensive telling of the story of the land once known as New Spain offers a new view. Focusing on Mexico's global influence, cultural development, and political evolution from the Spanish conquest to the present day, Mexico has been a pioneer in areas like social policy, inclusivity, and global economics. It was one of the first countries to abolish slavery and elect a black president. And along the way, it founded a small military outpost in the Texas wilderness that somehow thrived. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
TPR stands apart in today's crowded media landscape. We bring calm to a noisy world and offer space for thoughtful dialogue. Now, as we enter the new year without federal funding for public media, we are stretching to keep this essential service available to everyone. Visit TPR.org to make your gift today.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The history of Mexico has frequently been told as a timeline of tragedies, from the conquest to revolutions to losing half of its territory to the U.S. to the rise of the drug cartels. That's a narrow view, though. A more informed accounting of the story of Mexico reveals a global leader in trade, human rights, and culture. And that's the view provided in the new book, Mexico, A 500-Year History, by Paul Gillingham. And Paul Gillingham, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you. And eventually, hopefully, we can talk a little about how San Antonio fits into all this, or Texas fits into all this. And our listeners can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Got a question or comment about how we view Mexico's history, the story of Mexico. So, Paul Gillingham, why do we call Mexico Mexico? How did we come up with that name for that place?
Oh, Mexico comes from the original inhabitants of central Mexico, who are called the Mexica. We call them the Aztecs, but that was something we invented relatively recently. So the Mexica run an empire from what is now Mexico City, large lake city, one of the largest in the world, and one of the most sophisticated, until 1521, when they, of course, lost the city, not the country, to Hernan Cortes and a group of Spanish adventurers. And more to the point, well over 100,000 indigenous allies. So the conquest is something of a civil war, which the Spanish are very useful mercenaries in. Shortly after, you start getting, shortly being a historian, a mere 100 years, people start calling themselves Mexicans inside this Spanish territory. And so this is where formally it's Spanish territory, and it's dubbed New Spain in 1520 by Hernan Cortes. But people inside New Spain start calling it Mexico and themselves Mexicans relatively early on. And by the time you get to the beginning of the 19th century, this is common currency. Mexico is in many ways independent before it actually becomes independent in 1821. And the name Mexico is quite obvious when in 1821 they're looking for a name. You try different ones, try ones like Anahuac, which is the old name for central Mexico, but Mexico is the one that most people identify with, and it sticks.
Does it have a statement when the people who lived there decided that this was Mexico, we're Mexicans? Were they saying something by adopting that?
And it certainly distinguished them from the Spanish. Were they saying something? There was early national feeling, but it was quite constrained because Mexico was huge. remember, there used to be another 900,000 square miles of it north of the Rio Grande, all the way up to Oregon. And so expecting in 1821, people across this vast territory, going back to Guatemala, to wake up and say, oh yes, we're Mexicans, was slightly improbable. People are Tejanos, people are Yucatecos, people have local names. But as close as you've got to a single label for that entire territory, it's Mexican. And that's why it becomes the United Mexican States, which is something I think is worth holding in mind when we think about it vis-a-vis the US. This is another set of United States, another federal republic. They just happen to be Mexican ones.
You opened the book with the idea of the first Mexicans. Talk about that.
Mexico is really defined by being the world's first great melting pot. We tend to think of the US as that label, deserving it. But 200 years before you get these sort of waves of migration from Asia, from Europe, from across Latin America into the US, which makes the melting point pot. In the 16th century, towards the end, you have Asian immigration. You have indigenous migration up and down the entire continent. You've got European migration. It's not just Spaniards. And of course, critically and sometimes forgotten, you have a vast West African forced migration. As the effect of this is you have all these people thrown together, and what you get? You get a certain amount, quite a lot, of the sort of a multiculturalism, which we start getting in the US four centuries later. And because of that, if there was a single definition of what it is to be Mexican, it is to be precisely a sort of global hybrid population. And the first one who you could actually dub a Mexican, many Mexicans would say that's rude. You should go back several thousand years. And so you can with some continuity. But the first people who really fit that definition are three children of a shipwrecked Spanish sailor and a Maya woman who meet in the 1510s, have children, and they are the first what we would identify, I think, as Mexicans.
And so the father, the shipwrecked father, Guerrero, he plays a role with Cortes.
No, this is where you have this wonderful symbolism. So there's a reef called Los Alacranes, 60 miles off Yucatan. A ship gets wrecked on it in 1511. And only a handful of people get to shore, only two survive. And one is a priest called Jerónimo de Aguilar. He becomes a slave. The other is a sailor called Gonzalo Guerrero, and he marries well, and he's good at war, and he moves up the ranks of the local Maya society until in the end he's a warrior chieftain. And he actually leads the Maya of his region in war against the Spanish until they finally kill him in the 1530s. And so you really need to think of this Dances with Wolves type figure. That represents the sort of tolerant, the cosmopolitan, the sort of adventure of Mexico. Aguilar gets back to the Spanish as soon as possible and advises Cortes on how to defeat them. And here you have the more sort of parochial, violent side. And so in these two figures, you've got great stories, but you've also got really good symbols.
Yeah, elaborate on the symbol of that.
Well, just said that to be Mexican is above all to be heir to this hybridity going back centuries. So in Guerrero, you have somebody who produces the first, what we call mestizo, children from both Spanish and indigenous heritage. With Guerrero, you get the first mestizos, and you get this rejection of domination by a single power. In Aguilar, you get this far less cosmopolitan, far more predictable idea that the Spanish should rule, because they're Europeans and the indigenous people are indigenous peoples.
We're taking a break here. We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about the book Mexico, A 500-Year History. We're joined by the author Paul Gillingham. It is quite a book. It tells a lot of stories. Each page is a gripper. And we're going to get into Mexico and the United States. We had a war. Mexico lost. They lost half their territory. There's a lot there to consider. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Mexico, a 500-year history, a new book by Paul Gillingham. We're talking about Mexico's history. If you've got a question or a comment, call in 833-877-8255. So New Spain, then Mexico, they're able to claim all of this territory in North America, including Texas and up to California and beyond. How is it that they were able to say that this is all our land?
Because the United States, or the people who become the United States, are fundamentally a coastal strip until well into the 18th century. No, I mean, it's a very long coastal strip, but it is a strip. And then as you go west, you move into indigenous polities that really a lot of people don't have a clue about. What you do know is that you have this giant continental division decided, of course, in Europe, which gives you this triangle going all the way up to Oregon, where they run into the British again. And so you've got a line drawn there, and north of Oregon is no longer New Spain. Why is this doable? Well, because no one really has the power, or to a certain extent, the interest in extending real European, later American rule that far west. It's a question of cost-benefit. The cost is extremely high. The risks are high. The benefits are low until you get to 1848. And by that stage, when you strike gold in San Francisco and the world changes, Mexico is just on the brink of signing the surrender treaty, which will surrender not just San Francisco, but this entire 900,000 mile of territory to the United States. And when they do that, I was just going to say, there's this entire what if counterfactual history. What if Mexico had actually managed to hold on, and the San Francisco gold rush had actually drawn Mexicans by the thousands up north and northwest, as opposed to American settlers, the 49ers, no? And you can speculate really enjoyably, no? That first of all, gold would have paid off the national debt. Secondly, Mexico was full, the Mexican government was full of extremely sophisticated policy proposals. The key and obvious one was a national development bank to fund industrialization. The money would have been there. And so this is one of those moments, the Mexican-American War. The classic line is Mexico lost half the national territory. It really wasn't. It was nobody's apart from indigenous groups once you got much north of the Mexican border. It wasn't really a past at all, but it really was a future that Mexico lost in the Mexican-American War.
So the Mexican-American War, let's dig into that. So the United States, there's some astonishing kind of parallels to things that are going on today. The United States launches this war of aggression into Mexico, quickly defeats Mexico, Santa Ana. They occupy Mexico City. They force the signing of this treaty. There was even a question of whether or not the United States should take all of Mexico or not. Tell me more about all that. Is that a rough sketch of what happened? Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that absolutely this war starts in April 1846. On paper, it's quite quick, because you've got a three-pronged attack coming out of the US. One is going, a group going west to California, another is going due south to Monterrey, and then the really key one is a naval force under General Zachary, under General Scott, which comes round, lands at Veracruz, goes up a really quite forbidding set of mountains to get to Mexico City. And this entire war lasts for less than a year and a half, April 1846, September 1847. And the way you sketched it, you have this, the way it's generally believed on both sides of the border, Mexicans and Americans, that this was a relatively quick campaign of wealthier, better organized, more sophisticated, better led American army, defeating a Mexican army that was underfunded, ragtag, and led by this general who's entered history as a buffoon, or the archetypal sort of Latin American dictator. One of the joys of writing this book, sort of translating my colleague's work, the specialist academic work of the last 20 years, and what we've learned about the Mexican-American War in the last 20 years, really flips that round. A historian called Peter Guardino just sat down and read a huge tranche of soldiers' letters from the American side. And they really brought home the suffering and the difficulty. 1 in 10 Americans dies in that war. That's, out of a force of over 100,000, quite a few soldiers. And it happens really quickly. Losing that many people in a short time really brings home that it was quite a close-run thing. And several of the battles are actually very well planned by Santa Anna. Santa Anna is really quite good at two things. He's good at motivating people to join up, volunteer, and go to war. And he's actually really quite a good tactician. What he's not good at is getting his generals to obey him. And so they should bear quite a lot of the responsibility for this loss. And he's not really good at taking care of politics. He's good at getting into power. He's getting at making people do things. But then after that, it all tends to fall to pieces. And so, first of all, we have the idea that the war was a much closer run thing. Secondly, we really sort of have talked up Santa Anna's stock as a tactician. He was let down by his generals. He had some extremely good ideas, like using the geography of the mountains to keep the Americans bottled up in the fever-ridden lowlands and just let yellow fever kill them. And that was going quite well to the Battle of Cerro Gordo. And then when they came to Mexico City, he had the idea of flooding large parts of the city. He concentrated his forces in a really brilliantly designed cavalry ambush. The problem is, the general in charge of cavalry didn't much like him and ignored him. And once again, you see Santa Anna sort of brought down by his inability to use power. He can get it, he can have good plans, but then once it's there, quite often things fall to pieces. And then I think the really big thing, so we've got Santa Anna being a lot better general than we normally think. Secondly, we've got the Americans coming closer to defeat. This leads on to the third thing. You had what Abraham Lincoln called the fever dreams of the expansionists saying, and this is where it gets relevant for today, we've got an easy, cheap win, even if that's propaganda. Now, why don't we take over everything down to Central America? And the reason for sounder minds is because there's a lot of mountains in the way with a lot of people who really don't like foreigners. They don't like Mexicans from far away. They certainly don't like Protestant invaders from a long way away. And they have reliably killed people in large numbers who mess with them. And so it comes back to one of the great general truths, which is don't mess, well, with Texans, obviously, but don't mess with mountain men either. And they're really successful, these volunteer militia units against the Americans. They're in the way. And they're the reason why somebody like Lincoln apprises the situation and says, we've got as much as we're going to get. Now let's get out while the going is good.
They also, the American troops ran into violence from just everyday people in the streets of Mexico City.
Yes. And this is, again, something which has sort of come as a surprise recently to resurrect this story. And the old one was, the Americans march into Mexico City, it's all over. Looking carefully at a broad range of sources, we actually see that for 3 days you had really difficult urban warfare. And this is where you should think in terms of the present places like Baghdad, Mosul. You get a sort of overall, a lot of tenuous control, and then find out that your city dwellers aren't really happy that you're there. And they can say it with paving stones or bottles or things like improvised tear gas, which is chili powder. All of these everyday weapons are turned against the Americans. And for 3 days, it's very ticklish, to the extent where Santa Anna actually considers coming back and retaking the city. So at no point is it a stroll in the park. And in the end, America wins because it really is far wealthier. So it's got better cannon. Above all, it's got the ships to take Veracruz, stop anything from coming in.
The fact that this happened in Mexico, you know, in their own telling of the story, and they have the Niños Héroes tale, the children who died at Castle Chapultepec, and this is a story that looms large in Mexico's history, but in you talk to most Americans, they've never heard of it.
Yes, and it's an interesting sort of parallel, I think, to the Alamo. These are great stories that matter to the people in the locality where it happened. I mean, the Alamo is an amazing story. It's a stirring story. And the Niños Héroes is an equivalent. It's this sort of suicidal defense against overwhelming odds, where you have military cadets, teenagers, who fight the last, and then rather than surrender, jump off the battlements, one of them, Juan Escutia, wrapped in a Mexican flag. The problem is, as with so many good stories which move people and control them and make them do things, the Niños Héroes is quite possibly a total invention. You don't even see any record of them for 20 years. When they go out to find their bodies, they come across a mass grave of Mexican and American soldiers and just take six sets of bones, say, all right, these are the Niños Héroes, big state funeral, etc. At the risk of now having some really outraged questions, the Alamo similarly is something of a sideshow from the point of view of Mexico. But what an incredible story. So much power to move humans. So here you have these lasting, enduring semi-myths, and they work as with any sort of nationalist story because they are really compelling human stories, putting sort of people into a big abstraction, whether it's Texas, whether it's Mexico.
But this informs the psyche of Mexico and maybe even beyond Mexico in Latin America, where they see the United States as the aggressor, taking land. And they're informed by that when they see things like the United States threatening to invade Cuba, having taken over, you know, Donald Trump says he's now the president of Venezuela. That all is important information.
Yes, and one of the things that's really impressed me over the last week is the real balance in much of the Mexican media concerning Venezuela. Because you have, as you point out, well over a century of America using superior firepower and wealth to really try and run the hemisphere, you know? And especially in the Caribbean, where things are really doable. So you get rid of regimes who are anti-business, you get rid of left-leaning regimes, you protect banana corporations, oil corporations. You do what any other empire would do. I mean, this is what the British do, this is what the Romans do. There's a very limited way that humans have come up with organizing their society and their foreign policy. Empire is one of the key ones. The US is an empire. It acts like that. The problem is that some imperial moves are counterproductive. As I say, it was very savvy of the US, or at least avoiding something spectacularly dumb, to stop in Mexico City and not push into the mountains. Similarly, Venezuela, okay, really despised regime, kind of flat. Generally, at a popular level, quite pro-US. It is absolutely trashing international law, but strategically you might get away with it. As soon as you start talking about Cuba or Colombia, this is a wholly different kettle of fish. And I see this as really threatening the sort of losses and decades-long disdain of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And there is no way you can just walk into Colombia. No way you can just walk into Cuba.
Yeah, we just dropped into Venezuela and flew out in 20 minutes. So, you know, we're not there. We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue talking about Mexico, a 500-year history. Paul Gillingham is the author. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the new book, Mexico, a 500-year history, with the author, Paul Gillingham. You can call in with your questions and comments. What do you think about Mexico's history and how we relate to it here in San Antonio, in Texas? You know, we were part of Mexico. We were part of Spain. Call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to our caller, Randall. And Randall, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. You touched on something that brought something up here. I'm a 1984 graduate of Medina Valley High School, and that year I took the spring break trip to Mexico City with the school Spanish club, Los Compañeros. And you mentioned Chapultepec Castle, and there's that mural on the ceiling. You know, I don't know the name of it. You can find pictures of it online, but there is no substitute to going to Chapultepec Castle. Stepping into that room and looking up and seeing that mural, that boy, the expression on his face, leaping to his death, clutching the flag as he goes down. It's really, really something. Like I said, you can find it online, but you have to see it in person. I took a cruise about a decade ago, my wife at the time and I, and we went to Chichen Itza, and I remember them talking about how Chichen Itza is the Stonehenge of the Western Hemisphere. That painting, that mural in Chapultepec Castle, what is that? That's like the Sistine Chapel of Mexico or the Western Hemisphere. I mean, yeah, the Diego Rivera murals in the presidential palace are stunning in their own way. But
yeah,
like I said, I just had to share that. That's really something.
Randall, thank you for calling in. So Randall mentioned Chichen Itza, a Mayan ruin, not that far from Cozumel. Mexico has so many beautiful of these ruins, Monte Albán, Teotihuacan, and a lot of these are still shrouded in mystery. But your history that you tell in your book, Mexico, a 500-year history, starts when these were already ruins then.
Yes, and they had been for 600 years. And so it's one of those moments where you look at a different country's culture and realize that the timescale you're applying is just slightly off. And so you need to rewind and think, this is the equivalent, and I love the comparison to the Sistine Chapel. This is the equivalent of sort of 15th century Italian city-states. This is a Florence, this is a Siena. The sort of classic Maya world comes to an end around about 900. And that's a mystery. We can say there was overpopulation. We can say there was climate change. We can see people who we dig up sort of visibly shrinking before our eyes. Huh? What's tragic is that the Maya are a deeply literate culture. They're 1,000 miles away from Stonehenge, not just in terms of geography. And they actually preserve large amounts of information about that time, what are called codices, which are generally bark books. And you think of the Bayeux Tapestry, this is an equivalent. And when you put it together with people's memories, you really do have recorded history. And in one of the unambiguously destructive, hyper-violent pieces of Spanish history, that entire set of codices, 6 centuries worth, is burnt over 3 days by a single Spanish priest. And what you have, if you imagine every major library in America and beyond. It's actually unthinkable for us to erase so much of an entire millennial culture. And so all we're left with is the archaeology, a couple of codices, and trying to work out what it was like afterwards, this sort of image of living in post-apocalypse ruins.
So we're depending on the Spanish interpretation of what those cultures, what they were like and what they did. How accurate is that? Were the Spanish interpretations, things that are passed down to today, did they try to twist things in a way to make them worse than they really were?
There's always been very focused debates over things, obvious things like human sacrifice, arguments about the scale. Human sacrifice was adduced as a sort of reason for a just war. Of course, after we've dropped atomic bombs, or in the British case, firebombed Dresden, it's kind of difficult to really take a high moral tone about this. But the Spanish did for centuries, and they hadn't used the atomic bomb or firebombed Dresden. And it was sort of a sideshow in that very early on, the Spanish started producing histories and the equivalent of ethnographies, which really recognized the quality of the pre-Hispanic societies and cultures. And so it's actually the outside world that has made the Spanish rule, this really twisted version of in inverted commas, 3 centuries of a barbaric, despotic, destructive rule. My greatest surprise in writing this book, and I was trained on the 20th century, was to find how much recent research had completely shifted that to actually make the Spanish, as much as any imperial system can be, relatively hands-off, culturally sensitive, and part of that was actually valuing what had existed before they turned up.
The Texas Rebellion, the secession of Texas from Mexico, how big of a deal was that from the Mexican point of view? Santa Ana, you know, comes up to San Antonio, does the Battle of the Alamo, loses at San Jacinto. Was that seen as a big deal in Mexico?
Oh, absolutely. And it was seen as a big deal because, of course, the resources you've got, the fertile Gulf Plains, the cattle lands. It was seen also as being what it turned out to be, which is sort of domino in further US expansion. But this is something which is also sometimes forgotten, that the Texas Rebellion was just one of multiple, as the more peripheral parts of Mexico tried to split off. So Coahuila, which used to be joined together with Texas as a single state, Coahuila tried to do the same. Zacatecas tried to do the same. Yucatan tried to do the same. And the big difference is that Texas was the most successful because it actually did secede. What's interesting is, though, you have some alliances actually between Texans and those other rebel states. And so for 10 years, the Texans sort of sell naval protection to the people of the Yucatan Peninsula and parts of the Gulf Coast. And so Texas actually is not unique in what it's doing. It's slightly unique in the fact that it's so strongly Anglo, and it's unique in the fact that it wins. But if you look beyond that, actually it's deeply surprising that what's left of Mexico endures at all. Because at independence, Latin America fragments into these super states, giants with continent-sized polities, and they all fail, apart from Mexico. And explaining that over and over again throws you back on the overlooked success stories that take the improbability of Mexico and actually see as it historically endures.
You said the improbability of Mexico. I mean, you've said that it's a miracle that Mexico exists at all.
Actually, that was one of my reviewers, but I think they really got something there. Most Mexicans, with a sort of extraordinary mixture of pessimism and pride, which I really think is the two key themes in how Mexicans see their country, would say yes, it actually is rather amazing that this has worked out.
As opposed to falling apart into smaller countries breaking up like Central America.
Exactly. I mean, Central America actually was part of New Spain, so at the very moment of independence, it was actually part of Mexico as well. It is so easily imagined that one of the bits of Mexico we know best, the Yucatan Peninsula, no, it's surprising that that's still part of Mexico. Yucatecos, they see Mexicans historically as next door to foreigners, profoundly different. And there's this great story where even in the 20th century, people would be asked when ordering a beer, do you want Yucatan beer or foreign beer? And I think that tells you all you need to know. It's not just Yucatan. It's surprising that large swathes of the north, for example, the fact that Arizona hasn't sort of stretched into Sonora is also surprising. Sonorans are also, like Yucatecos, see themselves as very different from much the rest of Mexico, are very pro-American. And so this is another sort of counterfactual. Oh, well, actually, a strip of the north right at the beginning might have opted into the US. Of course, the Sonorans, there was no US there, so that probably wasn't going to happen. And then just the improbability of fighting off Spanish, French, and American empires and coming out the other side, not just with a remarkably stable republic, but one which is now the world's 13th greatest economy.
All right, we'll talk
That's
more about
surprising.
that when we come back from this break. You can call in with your questions and comments about Mexico's history and its identity. The number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll come back with more with Paul Gillingham, author of Mexico, a 500-Year History, when we come back from this break. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Paul Gillingham. He is the author of Mexico, A 500-Year History. Mexico banned slavery early on. That's part of your argument that you make, that Mexico is progressive nation and should be seen as a global leader. And why did Mexico say no more slavery?
Mexico said no more slavery because the people who won Mexican independence were, many of them of black ancestry, West African or what they call Afrodescendiente. And so it was a final expression of this really successful multicultural pluralist society that there was no way you could cut people of African descent out of the rebel forces and out of the subsequent republic. And you saw that most clearly in one of the key leaders of independence, is a warrior called, well, he's called Vicente Guerrero, which is why I call him warrior, because Guerrero means warrior in Spanish. And he is one more of these, in some ways, deeply American, sort of up by the bootstraps success stories, black mule driver from the coast around Acapulco. Absolutely keen recruiting people like him to help win independence. And then afterwards, he's made president in 1829.
He had the first black president in North America.
Yes.
So Mexico has this anti-slavery view. They have Texas. These people who are occupying Texas are coming into Americans, and they bring slavery with them. That's a point of contention. General Santa Anna leads his troops to put down the rebellion, but he also says he is there to end the free the slaves that are in the Texas territory. Is that part true?
Yes, and in fact, there's always a gap between ideal and reality wherever you go. In Mexico, it can be particularly large because this is a very big country which is very difficult to run. And so, while slavery is declared abolished more than once, indigenous slavery up in the north is still winked at. And slavery in Texas is one of three incentives. And I realize straight away that talking Texas history to a group of Texans is absurd because this is not my side of the fence. But from a Mexican perspective, it's interesting how much that first generation of Anglo settlers, led by Moses, then Stephen Austin, were actually wanted. And they were wanted so much. They were given 1,000 acres per family. They were given 7-year tax exemptions. And then, most controversial, they were given this exemption from the slavery ban.
Today we have Mexico dealing with these hyper-violent drug cartels. How does that fit into Mexico's history?
I call it a rupture. I think that it's very easy to essentialize Mexico as violent, unstable, corrupt. And I would argue that actually for any country in Mexico's conditions after independence, none of these really apply.
Now, yeah, but you can say the same thing about the United States.
Exactly. Or countries, the products of violence in the end. And yes, you certainly can say, though, in terms of sort of violent cultures, the US is in a different league. If you talk to a Mexican about political assassinations like JFK, RFK, MLK, etc., you talk to them about gun laws, you talk to them about school shootings, they will look at you as if you're slightly potty, that this is strange. And so the vision of Mexico now is being sort of intrinsically violent, that the history of the drugs war is just an inevitable progression, is just historically wrong. This is a major rupture with the patterns of Mexican history. And it's a rupture driven by really basic economics. Drugs, fantastic business as long as you keep them illegal. And America isn't just the richest country on earth, it's also the one with the highest rate of drug consumption. And one of the many surprises when you start going into it is actually, historically, Mexicans don't really do drugs. They're more concerned. When I lived there in the 90s, you know, nice parents were concerned about their kids sniffing glue or maybe having the odd joint. But the entire sort of panoply of serious drugs, Mexico just didn't really use them. And certainly not compared to the US, but there is so much money in supplying that illegal market. And that's where you start getting incentives for drug organizations to take over large swathes of territory. It's basic good business. And in every country, you have some good business people. Good business people are the epitome of drug organizations.
So Mexico, you know, it's, you write in a book about how it was a global leader economically, exporter of silver, all of this wealth being pulled out of Mexico during the colonial era. That, but you have to wonder why Mexico didn't do better economically compared to the United States. I mean, for a long time, it was seen as a developing nation, no longer, but it was that. And it was, is the story of Mexico, like we talked about with the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill in California, is it also a story of missed opportunities?
I would argue that it's far more than that. First of all, as you point out, Mexican silver revolutionized the world economy. It is everywhere. The peso is used in China, in India. This is really the foundation of the first global economy. The money doesn't stay, though, in Mexico. It makes a relatively small amount of generally Spanish miners and merchants and later great cattle estate owners extremely wealthy. But most of the money goes straight to Europe. And then from Europe, it goes to Asia or into fighting wars. So the silver changes the rest of the world. It doesn't change Mexico all that much. And then the great sort of divide between haves and have-nots in the modern period is industrialization. And here, Mexico is torn apart by war, just as the Industrial Revolution picks up speed. And being a late adopter of industrialization automatically puts people in a game of catch-up. But being a late adopter starting where all of the great industries, mining and textiles, are destroyed by 11 years of war, you then start to get capital for reconstruction. It's taken away by a British-caused financial collapse in 1826. You then have three empires looking at the natural resources in Mexico, which is self-evident. It's exceptionally wealthy natural resources. And thinking, but there's this already impoverished, weakened state. Let's see what we can get. And so you have, finally, appalling timing. The US gets independence at just the right point. It can trade with the rest of Latin America. Then the Napoleonic Wars come. It is superb timing. Mexico is in ruins, catastrophic, just as the rest of the world industrializes. And so it's playing catch up from the start. And that, and the fact that no one will lend to it, because that bridge collapsed for 80 years, give or take, it doesn't stand a chance. And the policy proposals are there. So often in Mexican history, you see really sophisticated policy proposals. There's a sort of national plan for industrialization, which would really have stood up well in the 20th century in terms of its sophistication, joined up thinking. But the money to start it just is never there.
Who is your favorite historic character of Mexico when you wrote your book?
Oh, that is such an extremely good question. And that's a bit like one of those questions, what's your favorite song? And you say, well, can I have three or can I have five instead? I think that there's a lot of people who are wholly unknown. I'm very interested in local communities. And so there are people whose names are wholly unknown outside sort of 20-mile radius, whose lives inspire me. The first person I studied was a rancher called Florentino Juarez, who lived in a very impoverished place. And it was so poor that he decided that to get income and power, he would forge the grave of the last Aztec emperor. This is not a sort of option which automatically occurs to people. This person in the middle of nowhere forged the grave of the last Aztec emperor as a way to get ahead. This is brilliance. This is sheer genius. In terms of people who are recognizable, the great social reformer, the president from the 1930s, Lázaro Cárdenas, would be an awful lot of people's choices. I think he would be one of my three. Benito Juárez, the first indigenous president, the only indigenous president in North America, managed to fight off the French Empire. Also, for a good reason, is a nationalist hero. So I'll go with those three. He's a rancher that next to no one except the ones who read my first book have heard of. And then two national heroes who punched so far above their weight on a really global stage and improved the lives of millions of Mexicans.
Cárdenas nationalized Mexico's oil. That's also back in the news now these days with Trump talking about taking Venezuela's oil. So there's lots of echoes there. Do you think we're out of time here, but clearly you think that Americans should know more about Mexico's history, the true history, not just the timeline of tragedies.
I do. And I think that it's both for the sake of Mexicans, but also for the sake of Americans, because so much of this country is influenced by Mexico, is manned by Mexican men and women. This is a key part of who we have become.
We're brothers. And Mexico, United States, we're brothers. All right. I got to thank you so much, Paul Gillingham. Thank you so much. Mexico, a 500-year history. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.